Radio in motion program loading in 3, 2, 1. Program activated.
Attention everyone, the unpleasant noise you are about to hear coming from your radio is not a mistake.
Okay, first things first, what is your name?
This is Big Sonny, playing the best of the 90s and beyond.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Radio in motion.
Please do not turn off your radio, but turn up the volume on your receiver as high as it can go.
All right, here we go.
Radio in motion.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. You're listening to Radio in Motion. I'm excited to have an amazing guest of a documentary which I've just watched, and I hope you all get a chance to watch it. It's called The Trust Fall. It's the story of Julian Assange, and we're lucky enough to have the director and creator here, Kim Staton, on the line. Are you there, Kim?
I am. Hi, Sonny. How are you going?
Good. How are you? Well, you can hear me. That is step one down, which is exciting. Thanks again for joining me. I'm really excited to have this opportunity. Like I say, I just recently watched the documentary, and I think, like I emailed you, I actually found it really, really powerful. And, you know, if anybody doesn't already know who Julian Assange is, as we go through tonight, I'm sure they'll get an idea of who he is. But first of all, I'd certainly like to introduce you as a award-winning documentary filmmaker. And, you know, just, I suppose, kick it off with asking you, how did you get into filmmaking and documentaries?
Sure. Well, I guess there's two parts of the story in regards to Assange and WikiLeaks. My first look into that was in 2010. I happened to be sitting on the couch in the living room when this video was on the news, a black and white video of an incident in Iraq during the Iraq War. And there was 12 people on a street corner, two of them journalists, and they were shot dead by an Apache helicopter flying up above a US helicopter. And then one man was still alive, crawling on the ground, and a van of civilians pulls up to try to help. There's a van with two children in it, and they pull up and try to help the man that's on the ground, and then the helicopter shoots up the van. And so this incident stuck in my mind because it's so awful. And I didn't know what it meant and who was responsible. It was probably five or so years later that I understood that that was a release of publication company called WikiLeaks, and I guess it's around 6 or 7 years ago, I just felt compelled to look more into the story, and I started watching a few documentaries, and then got inspired to basically try to help to make a film that could add weight to the campaign to help free this man who had done such a incredible service to all of us, to help with our understanding of the world. In regards to documentary making, I've been in the industry for 10 years, mostly showing other people's films on many different issues, impact documentaries, films about Indigenous issues, the impact of plastic on marine life, the treatment of animals in factory farms, and all of these serious topics. And I've seen how they can change people's choices. And I always had an idea that maybe I would make one, a film myself, if I had time and the ability to do it. And it was sort of one of those sort of dreams that you keep on the shelf until circumstances just made it possible. Up until 2020, the beginning of the pandemic, March 2020, we were running a very busy distribution company, Films for Change, showing documentaries in cinemas in 90 cities of the world, and that was very successful, and the pandemic meant that we had to move to streaming, and so now we have the platform filmsforchange.stream. And once that was running smoothly after a few years, I realized I was in a position to finally make a film and chose a nice, easy topic to start with.
Well, look, it's obviously a topic that I can certainly dive deep into, and I'm sure we could talk for quite a while. So if I start talking too much, you just stop me. But I wanted to talk about Julian Assange, you know, the man himself, really, you know, a boy from Townsville, Queensland, and founding WikiLeaks in 2006. And these are his words. Essentially, he's saying it's a platform to sort of circumvent the trappings of conventional mainstream journalism, and he sort of called it the world's largest bullshit detecting machine. Would you think that's an accurate representation from his cheeky point of view?
Well, at the time, it was an incredible innovation, an amazing invention that he came up with. It was there was two parts to his development. One was that it would protect whistleblowers, and if you can protect whistleblowers, you might just speed up the dissemination of truth and bring us more useful information of what's going on in the world. And WikiLeaks was the first big publishing organization to take on the mainstream narrative. That's no small achievement. Now we have many platforms that do that, and but at the time it was so unique and such a development. And the other part of it is to have a website, an electronic library that could never be demolished or burnt or erased. And he devised a way that there could be multiple copies of all of these documents, and inevitably when those responsible, those that had committed the crimes, try to bring that website down and they attack it and hack into it, then there would be multiple servers, and so the information can just pop back up again in another, from another server. And so not only did he come up with this brilliant way of protecting the source of the information, but also to protect that library itself, and that's a library of 10 million documents, which has been utilized by lawyers and professors, students, on a daily basis all around the world, and we've even for everyday people that have never looked into any of the leaks, any of that information, I can guarantee you it has shaped the world, and it's given us so much insight. For example, up until the Guantanamo Bay release, we didn't. The U.S. was claiming that they didn't torture, and that disclosure proved that there was torture going on with those prisoners. And so, we're no longer in the dark about the fact that they are still using torture, and it was even teenagers that were being held in Guantanamo Bay, and. Elderly people as well, up to into their 90s. And so just shocking releases that impacted the world in so many different ways.
He was a young man with vision and big ideas, and the most massive leak and the most important leak that had ever occurred in his backpack.
And the video you mentioned, obviously the 2010 video footage released and was uploaded of the U.S. soldiers, came to be known as the Afghan War Diary and the Iraq War Logs. And by the way, that, you know, again, I've been following Julian Assange, but that was, I watched it thoroughly, and it was hard to watch. And like you say, it was an important thing to see, because I used to believe that journalists, the whole point of journalists, a real journalist, and as he is, as Julian Assange is, the whole point was for them to follow the facts regardless of where they may have led. And, you know, he did that. He followed the facts. Would you say that's when he became an enemy of the state and became a target?
Well, of the U.S., there's differences of opinion of whether their sort of chagrin developed around the time of the Iraq and the Afghan war logs. The collateral murder video was part of the Iraq war logs, or was it later that year in 2010 when they released the Cablegate disclosure, which was mountains of emails exposing the U.S. Democratic Party to you know, many forms of corruption and disunity amongst that party. Or whether it was the Vault 7, which was the CIA hacking tools, showing that they were actually able to spy on their own citizens through all kinds of devices, smartphones and televisions and even inside your car. It was a huge year, 2010, and but, you know, the US were already making plans to bring Assange and WikiLeaks down as early as 2008, just 2 years after the beginning of WikiLeaks. So, you know, they already knew that this publishing company that was able to, publishing organization was able to challenge that, their power. They were onto it early and trying to clamp down on it, coming up with a plot to destroy Assange and WikiLeaks quite early on.
And, you know, going through a bit of a timeline and his, you know, really in incarceration for so many years now, in 2012, if people who don't follow the story, and again, I recommend everyone definitely watch the documentary or just find out about all you can about Julian Assange. He was seeking asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. And in 2016, apparently, that they found that the security actually hired to protect him were actually colluding with the CIA to provide them with video recordings and secret recordings of him. Did that surprise you at all? Or did you think, well, why not? They can do what they did before. Why not that?
Well, there's many examples and facets of the trampling of his human rights, of his privacy, of his ability to have a just trial. I mean, the whole basis of the extradition, the indictment on, you know, these espionage charges is all a fraud anyway. So before we even get into the extradition trial, so this whole pursuit of a journalist has been wrong in the first place from the get-go. So, you know, the CIA spying on Assange and his lawyers in the embassy is just one of many examples of how reasons that the case should be dropped and showing how hypocritical the US is to indict him on espionage while they're actually committing espionage against him. There's so many examples of hypocrisy in their actions and their behavior. Another one is that they claim that he's put lives at risk when this is a country that's been at war for 235 out of 247 years that they've been in existence. They've only had 12 years where they've not been at war, and they're responsible for millions and millions of deaths. That's, you know, that's some of the facts that WikiLeaks exposed in the Afghan war logs and the Iraq war logs. The Iraq war logs exposed 15,000 previously unreported deaths that the U.S. had tried to sweep under the carpet. And that number of civilian casualties is, and they're civilians, by the way, not people involved in the conflict at all. That number is, you know, greater than the number of people that perished in the 9/11 incident. And not to say that either of these incidents is worse, but just to point out how significant those unreported deaths must be to the Iraqi people, for them to not even be reported, all of their brothers and sisters and mothers, grandmothers and babies, and you know, that have been killed during that unneeded war.
You know, I think of journalists in history, and I naively thought journalists, you know, they used to be rewarded for seeking the truth. I think of Walter Cronkite or Mike Wallace, Woodward and Bernstein and Watergate. These were all revered journalists and not persecuted. Why is Julian Assange not being protected as the same way as journalists of the past have been protected?
Well, I think it's because in such a short time as 4 years from the beginning of WikiLeaks 2006 to 2010, when they started exposing the crimes of the US government, the cover-ups and the torture and the corruption, then that, I think they were very afraid of what he could do, that he would get in the way of their war machine, of their arms dealing, of their, you know, taking over countries under the guise of spreading freedom and democracy and all of the plans that they had in mind. It was just a nuisance to them, and there'd never been anyone that was so brilliant that could come up with these innovations to challenge their narrative and their power. That was incredibly worrying to them and disruptive to their unabated sort of ability to just go about their business of war. So, simple as that, you know. He's not just a normal journalist. He was an innovator and really on another level. And I think that's why some so-called journalists will criticize him and saying he's not a journalist, because he won so many awards, more than 24 journalism awards of the highest rank. And, you know, that's made quite a lot of mediocre journalists very jealous, and so that they enjoy saying that he's not a journalist, when what he really did was bring journalism to another level, a whole new level of accuracy. The transparency, the accuracy of the WikiLeaks disclosures is just flawless. It's so accurate. They've never had to redact anything, whereas your average newspaper redacts things probably every day. And so that's testament to how innovative this technology was, this encryption and this anonymous Dropbox, and the source of the information was straight from the source, straight from people that worked in organizations that wanted to report something that was not right. And so it wasn't a typical journalism of writing down whatever you think is going to make your sponsors happy, and using hearsay and rumor. This was straight from the source.
Well, that's it. I hear so much today, you know, versions of the truth. You know, it depends on your point of view. You know what, facts are facts, and I think a lot of times people try to warp the facts, even though they're obvious. With him being locked down for so long, and he's currently in Belmarsh prison, and I keep seeing images of him, and it just seems like, you know, is this a war of attrition for the U.S.? Do they want to just physically and mentally wear him down, which I believe they've done to others in the past, if that's the only way they can keep him down?
Well, that is definitely one of the strategies, amongst others. There's a document which we put up on the screen in the film. It's a document from a firm called Stratfor that the US hired them to give advice on how can they undermine and destroy WikiLeaks and Assange. And the basic advice was to chase him from country to country and bankrupt him in the courts. And, you know, they were basically weighing up options of what they can do, including, by the way, assassinating him. There was Mike Pompeo and CIA were reported by Yahoo News story a couple of years ago that they were actually had plans to assassinate Assange in London, poison him, or have a sort of stage a shootout on the street. And I guess they didn't do that because they'd get into trouble or they'd make a martyr out of him. And so what they decided to do was get him into prison, get him into custody, and just let him rot away for years and years until everyone forgets about him, and then keep him in solitary until he goes crazy. And that's what they've tried to do. And so he's been in solitary confinement 22 hours a day in a 6 meter square cell in Belmarsh prison now for more than 5 years.
Considering he's a native born Australian, do you think Australia has forsaken him and just bowed down to the US?
Well, all the politicians that have been in power since Julia Gillard, at the time that the persecution began and up until our current Prime Minister, have just been locking step with appeasing their US head honchos and done really absolutely nothing to help and not spoken out at all. And it's only the current Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, under the Labor government that have sort of shown some level of support. Albanese has had this mantra for about a year and a half now, enough is enough and it should be brought to a conclusion. But freedom of information requests submitted late last year have revealed that really the Australian government's policy is that they are very firmly committed to doing nothing, that they're quite happy for him to be taken, extradited to the US, put on trial, sentenced, and then only once he's received his sentence and he's put in a US prison that they might make some moves for him to serve his time in Australia. And that's as far as we've got in regards to the government. For the people, I think they're slowly starting to discover the truth about this situation. There's a lot of passionate and informed people, but the vast majority are still ignorant to this situation, or have some kind of prejudice against him, following the mainstream smearing narrative, or they just know nothing about it at all.
Yes, speaking of mainstream media, when you talk about that these days, when I say something like, oh, you know, I really don't listen to mainstream media because, you know, and of course you get labeled a conspiracy theorist, but how can you trust watching the news anchor when the next ad on TV might be about Pfizer or some other company? Again, I try to remind people that all those news programs are paid by someone, and so they can't be completely impartial. I never hear anything on mainstream media about Julian Assange. It's as if he's disappeared. Do you think that they've also been part of the character assassination? You don't need to assassinate someone. You assassinate their character.
Yeah, initially, in 2010, when the whole smear campaign kicked off, pretty much all the mainstream news were happy to pass around these smears, this defamation, the lies, and just print anything that they could think of, and they're all in cahoots with that. And but in recent years, you've started to see the story start to change. And there was about a year ago, there was five of the sort of the big newspapers, the New York Times, and Der Spiegel, and Le Monde, and a few others had finally wrote a joint letter saying that this was a threat to, that it would have a chilling effect on journalism, that you know, the extradition request was a threat to journalism. And I think you've started to see when these mainstream news outlets do cover the story, which is rare, they're starting to be a bit more neutral, occasionally starting with Julian. So it's sort of slowly shifting, but not fast enough. And Assange is basically trying to protect and enhance this profession of journalism to protect free speech. Free speech is fundamental to a free press, to journalism. So I don't understand at all that journalists that don't want to cover this story, maybe they're just lazy or jealous or to not want to defend someone who is defending your ability as a journalist to speak the truth and to put out truthful information is shocking and appalling. So, you know, every journalist should be doing whatever they can.
I agree, and you know, I feel like sometimes we're really living in 1984 Orwellian times, because you know, freedom of speech, you hear that phrase, but I also hear the phrase, and I'm going to ask you what you think about this. I hear misinformation. My belief is there's only information. Are we not smart enough to figure out for yourself what information you want to take? What do you think about the term misinformation that gets thrown around?
Yeah, well, I think there's so much misinformation in the mainstream media. They all repeat the same lines and the same narrative, the same catchphrases and headlines, and there's only a small group of people that own all of these media conglomerates, and Rupert Murdoch is one of them, and one of the Australian newspapers, The Age, actually did a smear piece just about a week ago, disgusting piece, saying that Assange was lazy and untidy, basically a dirty, ill-mannered person that was lazy. And I couldn't believe it in this, after all of that suffering, that this journalist, so-called journalist, would write something like that. But, you know, this is why we need WikiLeaks. We need a WikiLeaks in the world. The world would be better off if WikiLeaks or something like it was the source of information. It's always a problem, and it's a worsening problem. And there's over 500 journalists are in prison around the world today. Assange is just one of them. There's incredible suppression of information and censorship of journalists, and there's a huge lack of truthful information. And it's also a really worsening problem as far as finding the truth, because now we have all of these deep fakes, and AI can create videos, and you know, our ability to actually be in touch with the truth is really rapidly shrinking and becoming more and more of a problem. Any sort of footage can be staged and can be put out, and how do we know what's real and what's not in this age of AI? So if Assange was, WikiLeaks was still operating at full steam, and if Assange was free and hadn't been incarcerated and treated so shockingly, and was still working, I think someone like him would be clever enough to come up with a solution, and WikiLeaks could have developed, been much larger, and I think we could have prevented a lot of the conflicts and big problems that are going on in the world today.
You know, speaking of platforms beyond WikiLeaks and trying to keep, you know, real factual information out there to the people, do you think there's enough platforms around like Twitter or now X with Elon Musk, and again, you know, YouTube or podcast in general? Do you think there's enough uptake in those platforms, or are they still a bit murky?
Well, I think, you know, it's good that we have platforms like Rumble and Telegram, BitChute, that are sort of basically uncensored. Of course, you get a lot of rubbish in there, a lot of lies and propaganda and conspiracy theorists. And so, yeah, there's plenty of junk in there. And but at least there's an alternative news source and a source of information. And I think between the terrible state of mainstream media today and then this murky world of the independent media, the truth is in there somewhere, and it's up to, as you said, it's up to individuals to compare and contrast these narratives and different information and discover the truth, especially when we don't have a WikiLeaks operating. We have to work really hard to try to figure out what's really going on and what to believe. With X, with Elon Musk, you know, I think that Elon Musk is a very clever marketer, and he thinks that sort of appearing as a free speech platform will help X to grow, and it seems to be working. But I don't think that Musk has good intentions for the world, considering that some of the businesses that he's involved in with Neuralink and, you know, hooking up people's brains to technology and all of this sorted stuff. Yeah, it's very entertaining that he takes on the Australian government, and it's quite funny, really, that you can have this, you know, billionaire, you know, in a capitalist Western world that sort of has enough money to take on a whole country. It really sort of shows you how, in a free market capitalism, you can have one individual with so much money that they can actually take on a government, and that's kind of fun in a way. But, you know, one thing that really sticks out about Musk is that he's not willing to speak out on behalf of Assange. I've seen him do a little forum survey on his page where he said, you know, do you believe that Assange should be free, and Snowden, Edward Snowden. And so he's happy to discuss it and, you know, get a conversation going, but he won't actually express his own point of view, because he's just interested in making money and having power and business. And I think his purchase of Twitter was just to give himself more reach and more platform so he can sell all of his dodgy products.
I agree. I'll take the good and the bad with Elon Musk. I'll take the side. If the byproduct is Twitter or X is a more impartial and free open platform for people to have honest, truthful conversations, and then they can figure out for themselves what they want to take, I'll take that part of it. But yeah, he's certainly...
Yeah.
It's not like he's not drinking my money.
In the meantime, it is handy. You know, I notice when I post on there, I don't feel like I'm going to be shadow banned by, you know, mentioning certain people or whatever content it is, whereas other platforms, you have to, you know, put videos in comments and things like that. So, you know, in the short term, it's kind of handy to have a platform that is somewhat has some free speech. But he has been quoted saying, you know, that line, free speech but not free reach. So there is some shadow banning that can occur on the X platform.
Yeah, the other term you always hear, obviously, is, you know, fact checkers. What do you think about those? Because mostly they're companies that are bought and paid for anyway, and they'll just check your facts however you want them
to.
So what's a fact checker?
Yeah. They're not actually fact checkers. They're narrative checkers.
Yes.
Does this adhere to the narrative? It's hilarious, you know. We saw that during the pandemic. Like, anyone, you know, I don't want to get into, you know, that topic too much, because it's nothing to do with Assange, but... Yeah. But we can certainly say that anyone that had a different point of view during that period was deplatformed and quickly fact-checked. And even if they then came back and fact-checked the fact-checkers, and prove them wrong, they wouldn't admit that they were wrong on certain things. And you just see that over and over again. So it's completely bogus, unfortunately. The world needs a fact checker. It was WikiLeaks. Now we need, we need WikiLeaks to get back to its full powers, or a new WikiLeaks to come along that can serve that purpose.
You know, there's another side to this. Again, we could get deep into all this, like, you know, the evil oligarchy and the World Economic Forum. I could talk about that for hours, but I'm curious about, you know, sort of the lens of war. You know, I know America, and I'm from the States. I've lived here in Australia, though, half my life, so I'm a bit of both. There's the, you know, nothing against, of course, a soldier fighting next to another soldier and all of that. You know, when you're on the battlefield, that's different. But I think people forget behind it is the military-industrial complex. And what do you think about the phrase, you know, the endless war? Is that what America wants? A huge money-making machine forever?
Yeah, well, that's what Julian Assange, there's a famous quote, which an interview which we showed an excerpt of in the film, where Julian was talking at a Stop the War Coalition event in London in, I think, 2011, and he was basically saying that the Afghan war was planned as an endless war to wash taxpayer money through Afghanistan into the hands of a transnational security elite. In other words, warmongers, people that sell arms. And that was his impression. Other people have other impressions. When we interviewed David McBride, who's the Aussie whistleblower of the Afghan war, another incredibly courageous individual that is also interviewed in the film. I asked him about that, what he thinks the Afghan war was about, and he felt that, you know, some of these US wars are just to help that president get back into power, just to make them look powerful. Another fellow I interviewed in London, he was a refugee from Afghanistan. We didn't end up putting this in the film because it was sort of going off on another tangent, but he said to me that he was living in Afghanistan at the time, and they saw bags coming in, soldiers bringing in bags of guns and leaving with bags of drugs. So, yeah, there's a lot of corruption. There's a credible speech that Assange did at that same event, which I mentioned a minute ago, Stop the War Coalition event, and he rattled off all of these wars that were a result of lies. And he's certainly someone that has a lot of insight into all of that, and he saw a pattern where, you know, false flag events would start a conflict, and the purpose of it was to sell arms, and that's one of the problems of capitalism gone rampant. With unabated capitalism, where you don't have a watchdog media, you don't have whistleblowers, no one is brave enough to speak out. And in a society where people can make billions of dollars out of selling weapons, I mean, it goes back a long way for Assange, because even when he was at the University of Melbourne, before WikiLeaks, he was shocked to discover that arms manufacturers were hiring the university to design weapons. So this is a whole sordid, very dark part of humanity, of the state of the world as it is. People can, you know, we can all go down rabbit holes and explore these various wars and what were they really about. And that's when we see this pattern of, you know, coming up with some reason to kick off a war, a conflict, create a conflict, so that weapons can be sold, so that oil can be taken and territories overtaken, you know, by the country that perpetrated the war, that initiated the war. so, you know, we sort of touch on that in the film a little bit, and we have those excerpts of some of those speeches, and people can go and research further on that. And I think it's a really important thing for the world to wake up to is that, you know, the wars that are going on right now are not necessarily, conflicts that need to occur. And what are the real reasons for them? And it gets all very, very dark and sordid.
Yes, unfortunately, yes, like you say, money or some change of power in some way. So where does Julian go from here? As much as he's trying to fight for the truth, where does he go from here for his life?
Well,
his next steps.
Well, the current situation is that in 3 weeks' time, on the 20th of May, the UK High Court will hand down a decision as to whether Assange's defence will be allowed, permitted another appeal against the extradition, or whether the US can take him to America to go on trial for this 18-count bogus indictment, in which case he could be on a CIA plane almost immediately. So it's really getting to a very scary time for him and his family. You know, this is a show trial that's gone on for years. They've done it as slowly as possible. They've kept him in the solitary confinement in Belmarsh Prison all of that time, so that he will suffer. And he's spent all of that time not knowing how long he'll be there, what his future holds. That's all part of the psychological torture. And if he is taken to America, he'll be tried in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is known to be a place where the jury is not balanced, where that state happens to be where there's a huge predominance of employees and families of employees of these security agencies. So he won't get a fair trial. No whistleblower has ever won in that court. Mm-hmm. There's been many whistleblowers. In this case, Julian's a publisher of whistleblower material, but it's related, and they've never won. So it's not expected that he would get a fair trial. He would be kept under what they call special administrative measures, SAMs, which is essentially torture. So the US would likely torture him to get information out of him. And, you know, these are reasons why he's, at one stage they discovered in his prison cell that he'd hidden a razor blade so that he would, if he's extradited, that he would take his own life.
He looked at me intensely and said, "I hate to say this." He then hesitated, visibly troubled and searching for words. And then he finally said, "Please, save my life."
So, one more question, if that's right. Where do you think everyone goes for someone who is compelled to seek the truth? You said, you know, hopefully this was a wake-up call for journalists. Do you think this will still help people to feel brave enough to pursue the truth? Or will this just make them more fearful?
That's what, you know, big part of why they've treated Assange so badly is to warn off other future would-be whistleblowers and the journalists and publishers that might put out their information. It's a scapegoating. It's a threat to everybody. It's a scare tactic. And it's already having an effect, no doubt, on anyone that is a journalist. Any good journalist is going to have whistleblower material or, you know, disclosures and shocking news of corruption and war crimes and so on their desk from time to time. How could any journalist look at it and go, "Oh yeah, I'm going to publish that"? And so that's the plan. That's the strategy, is to prevent us, the public, from having that
So
most, but I think, you know, there's a lot of newspapers, journalists will say that if Assange is extradited, it will have a chilling effect. And whereas I would say, you know, by the looks of things, we're already in a sort of a journalistic ice age because of the treatment of Assange and hundreds of other journalists around the world.
So I was going to say, most importantly, when and where can they all watch this? Is it streaming? Will it have premieres? Where can they watch
at the moment? The film is in cinemas in Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. In the UK, it's really at a peak, coming into a peak at the moment, where we've had the largest cinema chain, Odeon, is showing it on the 8th of May, that's in 8 days' time, at 87 of their sites. So there's a lot of chance to see it in a cinema in the UK. Australia and New Zealand have had hundreds of cinemas involved over the last few months, and we bring it to US cinemas and Europe very soon as well. And we firstly want to show the film in that cinema setting, because it's such a powerful way to see a film, where you have your attention is very focused, and the big screen and the big sound, and because it has had the ability to get into cinemas, we're keen to continue that. And once that finishes up, we'll certainly have it on streaming platforms. We already have arrangements for Apple TV and Amazon and so on, and hopefully some of the big streaming platforms and to free-to-air television.
Well, that's excellent. I'm glad that it's going to get out there, because I guess that's the thing is, you know, you want people to watch, and we tend to be very lazy these days, and we just sit at home and wait for streaming. So, yeah, that's good to hear that it's going to be on multiple platforms to get out there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we will continue sharing the film until Julian is free. That's what we intended with the film, was to add weight to his campaign to free his freedom, to inform people, raise awareness, and raise mass awareness, so that there will be more pressure on the governments to do the right thing.
Well, again, I can't impress on people enough that they should definitely check the documentary out, however they can. The Trust Fall, Julian Assange. And I thank you so much, Kim, for joining me tonight, having a chat. I feel like we could have a huge deep dive in anything, so feel free to call back anytime and have a chat, all right?
My pleasure, Sonny. And thanks for covering this film and this important urgent issue, and great to chat with you.
That's all right. Thank you so much. All right. Talk to you later. Have a good night.
Take care.
Thanks.
Bye.
All right. Kim Staton and The Trust Fall, Julian Assange, definitely a powerful story, and, you know, obviously something that's happening right now. And I encourage you all to, as I always say, don't just take my word for it. Go online and make your own opinion, but definitely understand that, Julian Assange, how he's treated, don't feel that it can't touch you and can't affect you. Something like truth and fact and freedom of speech, and someone who's just trying to be honest, when they're persecuted, just know that that can always trickle down to you in your lounge room, in your neighborhood, your family, your children, your schools, or yourself. I'm just being honest. Don't think that it's so far removed that this story isn't something for you. I think his story is a story for us all, and I definitely hope you tune in. All right, thanks for listening tonight. We got some more great music tonight on Radio Motion. Tonight we're going to do a bit of a fight night theme, because obviously with a story like Julian Assange, I'm feeling like songs that I need to go out and I don't know, hit the punching bag or go for a jog or just get motivated. So there'll be some great tracks coming up tonight. First, we'll hear from a word from our sponsors.